best of our knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, what's your favorite board game? We'll explore the history of board games in America. And we'll visit an upstate New York woodworking shop that is opening its doors to the community. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Board games are big. More than a century and a half after the first widely available game was published in America, the multi-billion dollar board game industry continues to grow. Julia Karine Dietar is a video game designer with company Spry Fox and something of a board game historian. Julia has studied early board games in America. We spoke about games, their design, and the game that touted itself as the first board game ever published in the U.S., The Mansion of Happiness, first printed in America in 1843.
So, I mean, board games have been around for centuries, and actually The Mansion of Happiness comes out of a really well-known genre of games called the Royal Game of Goose. That was known for centuries in Europe. I think the issue is that before the 1800s, board games, because they're like so object focused, I think there was a lot of like work put into them to show off the idea that their owners had a lot of wealth, not just because they had a lot of free time, but like, as you could see in this Royal Game of Goose example, there's like gold leaf printing. There's a lot of like handcrafted and fine finesse that goes into crafting the pieces and the board art. And so a lot of times people would use board games as a way to kind of show off, like, look how wealthy I am. And I think that, you know, board games were not so common among everyone in the like 1600s and 1700s in the way that like card games were, or, you know, playground games were, or like, you know, simple sport, you know, sports were. I think those were more accessible. So in order for, you know, board games to become more accessible by the masses, there was a technology that happened in the middle or the early 1800s, and that was the lithography printer. And the lithography printer allowed it like tens of thousands of copies to be made. Before this, you had copper plate printing, and this would like start to break after around 2,000 prints. The prints would start to deteriorate after you would make so many. So it just was really limiting in terms of its your ability to print books and as well as board games. And so after this technology, you really start to see people being able to afford books and board games, like, you know, in mass more, you know, you have the middle class also coming into view in the like 1800s versus something like the 1600s or the 1700s. You have a middle class that has like some disposable income, and then you have this technology that is able to mass produce these things. And then you start to see things like the Mansion of Happiness coming into people's homes. There's an earlier board game called the Traveler's Tour of the U.S. that was printed in 1822. But because it used an older technology, there was few of these around, and so fewer survived, you know, the test of time. And this game wasn't discovered until later. And that's why for a while historians thought that this was the first published board game.
So Mansion of Happiness, the first published board game. How popular was this game at the time? Now there are certain games where I feel like everybody has in their home.
Mm-hmm.
Monopoly,
yeah.
Scrabble,
mm-hmm.
Some other games like that. But was Mansion of Happiness in the 1840s, 1850s, was this a game that was entering the homes of Americans across the country?
Yeah, it was. And I think the reasons why it was so successful is that, one, it does look familiar to maybe people who have played these types of like Royal Game Goose. And, it, you know, it is a simple game in terms of it's, you know, you roll, well, you don't roll die here because this Mansion of Happiness, it has a very like religious theme to it. And so there's this stigma around dice about, you know, the association of gambling and devil's bones and sin and that kind of thing. So they got around this by using something called Titoims, which are tops with numbers on them.
It looks like you would spin them. It looks like a die with a top stuck to it.
I have a middle one. This is all these images are, by the way, from the Strong Museum in Rochester, New York. They have this amazing museum about the history of play and the history of board games and the history of all sorts of stuff. So they have these extensive collections. And yeah, they have a photo of a Titoim that looks exactly like die. And I just love it because it's like, that's less sinful. Okay, that's acceptable, but like using regular dye isn't. It's really funny looking back at it. But there, you know, the stigma of, you know, playing games on a Sunday, I guess was very, you know, that was something that people had to contend with. It was not seen as cool to be playing board games with your kids on Sundays. So I think one of the reasons the Mansion of Happiness was so successful is because it had this very, very religious overtone to it. It's like, oh, you're not really playing a game. You're learning about how to be a good religious, devout person. And so using things like T2Ms, we're able to like get over that. Like, oh, it's a top with numbers. You're not really using dice.
So when did board games begin to move away from, I guess, the religious theme or catering to make them more palatable and acceptable to a cautious public?
Yeah. So I think you really start to see this change. The next big blowout game that kind of happens that takes over the U.S. is the Checkered Game of Life. And this one is a modified checkerboard where Milton Bradley, he had a lithography printing company and he had a whole bunch of pictures of Abe Lincoln without a beard and he couldn't sell them. So he was trying to save his company and he was like, well, let's try making a board game. And he makes this game. It's also a racing game. You start in the lower left and you try to make your way up to the upper right. The lower left is marked infancy and the upper right is happy old age. But you have these like elaborate themes, just like the Mansion of Happiness. You have like poverty and school and disgrace. You even have suicide on the board game, which is like, again, when you're looking at this, you're like, that's a Milton Bradley game. But like in 1860, I think he was trying to like map life's ups and downs and how your choices can lead to those ups and downs. So things like going to school can lead to ambition, which could lead to being productive, but it can also lead to ego, which could lead to fame and can lead to ruin. And so he has these kind of different maps. But this is a really great example of, you know, in the next 20 years when this comes out, this came out in 1860, you see this change. It's not so religious anymore. Now we start to see the American culture of like, being productive and going to school are all really good things that we value. And like pulling yourself up by your bootstraps is like something that we want to teach kids. So you see the shift between something like the Mansion of Happiness, where it even says in the instructions, like, if you're happy in this lifetime, you're probably doing something wrong, which is like, it's so weird for people today to like look back at that and be like, what? You know, but it was so religious that it was like happiness you get when you die. Like the last space in the Mansion of Happiness is the everlasting happiness of the afterlife versus the Checkered Game of Life. It's happy old age. It's like you could be happy in this life. That's OK. Like and you can be happy by going to school and being productive and, you know, you're working really hard and applying yourself. And
I want to say that the Checkered Game of Life does not really resemble the game of life that we know today with the little cars and the people. And
so to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Checkered Game of Life, the company, Milton Bradley, they hire a designer to redo it. And he basically, the designer's name is Reuben Clammer, and he redesigns it completely from scratch. And one thing I love about the Checkered Game of Life and the Game of Life in general is it just shows these snapshots of like American society. So like the Game of Life, this one comes out in 1960 because it's 100 years after. And of course, like highways are transforming the nation. And so it seems quite obvious that your like life transport vessel is a car, right? And it's interesting to see how different it's changed. In the Checkered Game of Life, you know, you're trying to apply yourself. And yes, there is some like, you know, emphasis on wealth. But in the Game of Life, you know, your whole value is basically the amount of money you make. Right? You have two choices at the beginning, which is to go to college or not. And then at the end, you're trying to retire to millionaire's estate or you'll be banished to the poor farm, which is different than trying to get to happy old age. Right. So there's a little bit of a change that has happened. And then there's an additional version that happened with the Game of Life in 2007, where they tried to get away from money being your life value point system. So they have these different tracks where they try to, you know, encourage things like learn it or experience it or earn it. But these points are kept track of via a Visa branded credit card. So it's just interesting, again, to look back at each of these distinct sections of this board game and being like, yeah, that makes sense. That I could see how the culture kind of like, you know, makes its way into the design.
So what do you think makes a game have staying power? And I mean, we're still playing the Game of Life. And as you mentioned, it was in its initial version came out 150 years ago,
yeah,
almost.
It's
so
pretty crazy.
What gives a board game staying power? What makes it effective, do you think?
I think, you know, it's partially nostalgia. Like, these are games that you grew up with and that you played with and that you are familiar to you. And part of it is just there is something really nice about this this story that you get to participate in, right? You're going through a track, but there's also this elaborate, like, theme over it, which is, like, the story of your life. And, like, going through that is just really interesting to kind of see how it would unfold. There's not too many choices in these games. Like, both, again, these are racing games, so they're, you know, you roll die and you go up and down a track. There's not, like, a lot of strategy. It's not like something like Settlers of Catan where you're, like, planning out where you're going to put your houses and your roads and there's more, you know, there's more ways to win. I think the staying power for a lot of these American board games is the story behind it. And if you think about, for example, something like Fireball Island or Mousetrap. These are like really awesome,
really involved,
involved games. And yeah, they're just so amazing because it's like you're telling a story and there's like so much like anticipation, especially like with Fireball Island where you're like dropping the fireball and you're watching it go down the tracks. And like, yeah, you don't have much choice in where you know, what number card you drew or what die you rolled. But like, the anticipation of the story that will unfold is like really captivating.
Also, the promise of the contraption at the end of Mousetrap.
Oh, yes.
I played Mousetrap all the time, and I never really had a problem with setting it up. I always thought that was...
Oh, that was all the fun.
Yeah, that was all the fun.
That's the whole fun of the game. I mean, the game, again, like in terms of like the strategy or the mechanic, for something like Mousetrap, it's like, yeah, I mean, you're going, you know, again, you're like going down a path, and you know, you'll do what the cards say, but like... The total selling point is like watching that Ruby Goldenberg machine go off.
So let's talk about Monopoly.
Okay.
Because
yes.
Monopoly's been around for a long time. As I understand, the board game version of Monopoly that you and I and everyone knows with Mr. Monopoly and the car and the dog, that's not the original version of Monopoly.
Yeah. So Lizzie McGee is the woman that invented the Landlord's Game, which is the game that Monopoly is based on. And she's just like this incredible woman. She was a stand-up comedian in 1890, which is, just blows my mind. She was a very like active women suffragette and abolitionist. But above all, she was a Georgist. And so so Henry George is this economist in like the 1870s, and he's trying to understand why there's like so much wealth inequality in the U.S. And so he comes up with this idea of like reforming the economy, which is called the single tax method. And basically the idea is like, if you invent something, or if you produce something that improves other people's lives, that should be rewarded and encouraged, and you shouldn't be taxed on it. But if you are making your money off of, you know, mining coal or oil, or you're a landlord and you're just getting rent from the earth, that should be really heavily taxed, because everyone should be sharing in the earth's bounty, and we shouldn't be encouraging kind of like rent taking, basically. And so she wanted to make a board game to teach people about the single tax method. And that's where the Landlord's Game comes from. She patents the Landlord's Game in 1904, but she's been developing it for a while before that. It looks very, very similar to Monopoly, but you have a jail, you have a poorhouse, you have railroads, and then you have labor upon Mother Earth produces wages. So that's your go. You have property cards. And at the end of the game, the person with the most money wins. So the same goal as Monopoly. But the biggest difference between Monopoly and the Landlord's Game is that there are two rule sets in the Landlord's Game. The first kind of is similar to Monopoly, where if you land on a property, you could pay for the property, although every other player can outbid you from the start. So it puts a lot more stress on you landing. So in Monopoly, you could just basically Monopoly has like one strategy, which is like whatever you do, buy whatever you can land on, because the, you know, advantages for owning property just far outstrips everything else. That's like your only income generator. But in the Landlord's Game, landing on the spot actually puts you at a disadvantage because people can command your rent right away, and that could subsidize your bid. So you could say like, oh, I want to buy like Connecticut Avenue for 100. I mean, this is not the same thing. She doesn't have Connecticut Avenue. She has different types of property things. But the idea is like, oh, another player could be like, well, I'll buy it for 110. And then another player will be like, well, I'll be 120. And it'll just keep going until somebody taps out at the end, and that's who gets the property.
Monopoly has a lot of strategy and metagame to it, if you will, where you, at least when I play with my friends, it becomes, all right, well, let's form an alliance where I don't have to pay rent on your properties and you don't have to pay rent on my properties, but we're going to go after this player.
Oh, yeah.
And then it gets really cutthroat. And mm-hmm. and I feel like a lot of games now in the 21st century are kind of encouraging a lot of that back and forth banter that might be beyond the hard and fast instructions on the manual.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the house, as you said, the house rules kind of make the games. I mean, even with the simplest games I play with my kids, I brought in like the sneaky snacky squirrel. And there's one space where you spin the thing and it's like, oh, the wind blew all your acorns away. And that's just really bad loss aversion for little kids. So it's like, no, you just lose one acorn, you know. And I think having house rules allows you to bypass like awkward situations that board games can put up. But that's also why board games are so cool. And I think the reason why, I mean, the board game industry has gone through so much in the last 20 years. Just the fact that there are so many different types of board games now and so many people are playing them. But a lot of times they're playing on all these different aspects of what makes board games interesting. And one of them is just the social setup of the table. Like, how are you playing with other people? How are you making those alliances? How are you striking those rule systems? And how does that make you feel with other players? I just, you know, so, yeah.
So, Julia, you are a video game designer by trade.
Yes.
How much of a good game design from board games translates into video games? And maybe what works well in video games doesn't work so well in board games. Are you ever taking lessons from the board game hobby or playing with your kids that then you are trying to fold into or tap into when you're working
Absolutely.
On a video game?
Absolutely. And I'm so excited that, like, I feel like when I first started out in video games, like 20 years ago, it seemed like these two industries were pretty siloed. Like, you know, video games were over here and board game designers were over here. And I think finally over the last 10, 15 years, that's become much more blurred. And I think that's just great because I think there's a lot of things that we can teach each other through, like, you know, what are those, like, interesting loops that you're using in board games and how does that translate in terms of like social play that we could use in video games. So I'm like super encouraged to see a lot of like crossover between them. There is definitely differences, like, you know, on one hand, making a tutorial system for board games seems so complex because it's like, here's the box, you know, like here's all the pieces, here's everything, let me try to teach you a board game, and that could be like really overwhelming, whereas I feel like video games have the luxury of being like, well, the computer can hide these things, so until you hit level one, we don't have to worry about the 800 other, you know, things that you might encounter in the game, so we're able to like have a much easier process in terms of onboarding and teaching games to players, whereas I think board game designers have to do a lot of planning and design around how you set up the instructions and how you bring people on to playing games because it's just a lot that's just all there.
Where do you see board game design going next? And what's something that you think has yet to be accomplished? Is the sky really the limit here?
I think it is the limit. I think that it's just the transformation, again, in the last, like, 15 years. Like, seeing things like Wingspan becoming, like, mainstream.
Wingspan is a bird-watching game.
It's a bird-watching game. It's a game about collecting and identifying different types of birds. And, like, the fact that that is, like, so mainstream and just catches different, like, a niche audience of people who are super into birds, it's just amazing. And I would love to see more of that. And I think we are seeing more of that. There's so many board games that not only are just diverse in terms of their mechanic, like, you know, is it a co-op game or is it, like, you know, an intrigue game or a mystery game, but just like so many different themes and stories and perspectives that you can learn about from board games. So I'm like really excited that we're in this kind of golden age of board games, and yeah, I'm trying to play as many games as I can. So,
well, Julia, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much for having me. It's such an honor.
Julia Karin Dietar is a New York-based video game designer and board game enthusiast. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. Do you know your way around a woodshed? Many students will learn some woodworking in their middle or high school technology classes, but not all of us are privy to the ins and outs of a joinery. A wood shop in upstate New York is opening its doors to anyone who wants to spruce up on their sawing or sanding skills. WAMC's Aaron Shello Levine reports from Saratoga Springs.
It's a cloudy morning in front of what used to be the Spa City's Children's Museum. Board members, volunteers, and local officials have gathered for the grand opening of the Saratoga Joinery, a place to saw and be seen.
Two, three,
joinery! All right.
Founder John Holler says getting going took longer than expected.
It's going to be a neat addition to the community. We have a plan. As we've learned, everything changes, so we're going to listen to what people want and see how we can add value to the community over time. But we're open. So, yay.
Inside the 8,700-square-foot community-centered space, board member Eric Diem explains the layout.
So basically the joinery is set up into two rooms. Two floors, two rooms. This is the power tool room. Upstairs is a classroom. We can go up there and a bench room. Bench room in woodworking parlance is typically hand tools. Chisels, planes, hand sanding. Less noisy, more zen-like. This is the noise-making room.
The bottom floor is, without a doubt, built to be noisy. Top-of-the-line table saws, band saws, milling tools, and a jointer are spaced out across the first floor, connected by a hanging system of vents that vacuum sawdust as it's made at each station. With mandatory safety lessons given to each newcomer and rules and safety checklists hung up throughout the facility, DM jokes that for each finger lost, the joinery would lose dozens of members, so it's best to avoid any accidents.
So table saw injuries account for majority of injuries in woodworking, so these are both saw stops. Saw stops have technology built in, it's the only one sold in this country, where it's got flesh sensing. So if somebody does hit their finger on it, the blade drops down and gets stopped in a millisecond. So it's really phenomenal. So safety is our number one issue here, right? I mean, we quickly will become unpopular if we're not safe.
Dave Floyd is a retired elementary school teacher turned joinery volunteer who is decades into his woodworking hobby, posing with a handmade sign crafted from a cherry tree he cut down during the pandemic. Floyd says there's value in sharing creative space.
Oh, it's fantastic. Every time I walk in the door, I learn something. You know, there's one person has a great saying of there's not a right way of doing things, there's different ways of doing things. And how I might have cut this is one way, but someone else might have to say, oh, I never even thought of trying that. So every time I walk in the door, something new.
With a roughly $500,000 budget for its first year of operation, Holler says membership fees need to be subsidized.
This is an expensive place to run. And if we priced memberships to cover our expenses, it would be out of reach of the people that we're trying to attract to this space. So we want new people that don't have exposure to woodworking, to get involved. And the second thing is we really want to be a value to the community, so we want to do community projects. The best thing about being a not-for-profit is that we get these amazing people that want to help us out. So we have just people knocking on the door, people that come in here and they ask, you know, I love this place, how can I help?
The joinery is already making a local impact, having signed on to reconstruct the latticework of 65 Phyla, a historic downtown home that was nearly demolished. In addition to increasing memberships and community projects, Holler says he'll be measuring the long-term success of the joinery by its educational impact.
We are going to run classes, so how many classes we can run and the enrollment in the classes. So we hope that we're going to have teachers that people love, and there's word of mouth, and they have multiple classes, so people are going to sign up because they like the teachers. We have a lot of capacity to run classes.
That story from WAMC's Aaron Shello Levine. You can learn more about the Saratoga Joinery at its website, saratogajoinery.org. You're listening to The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. If you'd like to tell The Best of Our Knowledge what you think, send us an email at knowledge@wamc.org. You can listen to The Best of Our Knowledge anytime as a podcast, downloadable wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to catch up on past episodes or hear more WAMC National Productions programs on the news, academic study, books, women's issues, the media, and the environment, visit wamcpodcasts.org. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1748. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Thanks to associate producer Jody Cowan, the latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, wamc.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.